homo loquens, in the title I announced for this lecture, means speaking man, man the speaking one. As a designation for the human species, homo loquens perhaps has an advantage over the official zoological designation homo sapiens, man the sapient, wise, discerning one, the one who savors the essences of things. The human capacity for loquaciousness is somewhat more obviously verifiable. But what has that capacity to do with things biological? This is a complicated and problematic topic. Forgive me if I first approach it by slow stages, then attempt a gingerly step when the going becomes treacherous. I wish to begin with a small technical matter, an aspect of the physiology of speech production. Respiratory patterns in different species of air-breathing vertebrates differ in many details. Different species have special regulatory systems adapted to special behavior patterns. There is the panting of dogs, specially adapted for cooling. Birds, during flight, have the unique ability to increase their intake of oxygen 100-fold. The sperm whale can go without breathing or dive for 90 minutes, the beaver for 15, man for about 2.5, and so on. All these differences are species specific. In a human being, the respiratory patterns during quiet and breathing and during speech are remarkably different. The volume of air inhaled, as shown in the first item of the table, increases by a factor of 3 or 4 during speech. The time of inspiration, as compared with the time for a complete cycle of inspiration plus expiration, decreases by a factor of 3. The number of breaths per minute tends to decrease drastically. Expiration, which is smooth during speechless breathing, is periodically interrupted during speech with a buildup of pressure under the glottis. It is during expiration that all normal human vocalization occurs. The patterns of electrical activity in expiratory and inspiratory muscles differ radically during quiet breathing and during speech. Both chest and abdominal musculature are utilized in breathing, but during speech, the abdominal musculature is less involved, and its contractions are no longer fully synchronized with those of the chest musculature. In quiet breathing, one breathes primarily through the nose, during speech, primarily through the mouth. More than you wanted to know, I'm sure. My point was that breathing undergoes marked changes during speech. And remarkably, humans can tolerate these modifications for almost unlimited periods of time without experiencing respiratory distress. Think now of other voluntary departures from normal breathing patterns. If we deliberately decide to breathe at some arbitrary rate, say faster than ordinary, please do not try it here, we quickly experience the symptoms of hyperventilation, lightheadedness, giddiness, and so on. Similar phenomena occur when one is learning to play a wind instrument or during singing instruction. Training and proper breathing is requisite for these undertakings. By contrast, talking a blue streak for hours on end comes naturally to many a three-year-old. The conclusion must be that there are sensitive controlling mechanisms that regulate ventilation in an autonomous way during speech. More generally, it is evident that we are endowed with special anatomical and physiological adaptations that enable us to sustain speech for hours on exhaled air. Do we speak the way we do because we happen to possess these special adaptations? Or did these adaptations develop during evolution in response to the pressures of natural selection or the charms of sexual selection? I think there is no way of answering these questions. It is difficult enough when one can refer to skeletons which fossilize. Behavioral traits do not. But whatever the answer, there is still this further question, whether the genetic programming for speech extends beyond the mere provision of vocal apparatus. Might it not, in addition, determine the makeup and structure of language in a more detailed and intimate fashion? Such a question runs counter to views that are widely held. Is not language, after you have a voice to pronounce it with, fundamentally a psychological and cultural fact to which biological explanations would be largely irrelevant? Do not languages consist of arbitrary conventions made up in the way we make up the rules of games? Wittgenstein speaks of language as a word game, thereby likening it to tennis or poker. Is it not apparent that the conventions of any particular language, like the rules of tennis or poker, are transmitted from generation to generation by means of imitation, training, teaching, and learning? Are not these the important facts about language, the facts that reveal to us its nature? Until recently, students of linguistics and psychology have tended uniformly to answer these questions in the affirmative. To many, the extraordinary diversity of human tongues has seemed argument enough against any assumption of linguistic universals, that is, characteristics of language imagined to be rooted in human nature. The reductio ad absurdum often mentioned is the attempt of the Egyptian king Psammetichos to determine the original human language. As reported by Herodotus, Psammetichos caused two children to be raised in such a way that they would neither hear nor overhear human speech, the attendants being instructed meanwhile to listen out for their first words. The report was that it was Persian. The experiment is said to have been repeated in the 13th century by Frederick II, Holy Roman Emperor, and again around 1500 by James IV of Scotland, who was hoping that the children would speak Hebrew and thereby establish a biblical lineage for Scotland. No result was reported. Stress on the arbitrariness of language has been enhanced by a coalition between linguistics and behaviorist psychology. Behaviorist psychology is led by its premises to the view that language is merely an arbitrary use to which the human constitution, anatomical and physiological, can be put, just as a tool can be put to many arbitrary uses by its manipulator. A recent account that views language in this way is the book Verbal Behavior by B.F. Skinner. Along with other behaviorist scientists, Skinner holds that all learning can be explained by a few principles which operate in all vertebrates and many invertebrates. The process is called operant conditioning. Learning the meaning of a word, Skinner holds, is like a rat's learning to press a bar, which will cause a buzzer to sound, announcing food pellets soon to come. Learning grammar, likewise, is supposed to be like learning that event A is followed by event B, which is in turn followed by event C. Many an animal can be trained to acquire associations of this kind. Skinner would hold that there is nothing involved in the acquisition of language that is not involved in learning of this kind. Unquestionably, we would be mistaken to deny the importance or the power of the conditioned reflex, either in language acquisition or in other learning. The experimental psychologists have recently announced that even the visceral organs can be taught to do various things on given signals, with rewards provided immediately afterwards to reinforce the action. We are told that rats, with the reward held out of another shot of electrical juice in a certain center of the brain, have been taught to alter their blood pressures or brain waves, or dilate the blood vessels in one ear more than those in the other. Similar achievements in operant conditioning are held out as a bright future hope for humans. What rich experiences in self-operation are not in store for us? On the other hand, the successes of this technology do not necessarily tell us much about the character of what it is that is being conditioned. The behaviorist treats the organism as a black box. He controls the inputs and records the outputs. What goes on in the box is not, he claims, an appropriate concern of his. He cites the similar situation in quantum physics. In the case of quantum phenomena, the physicist cannot successfully describe what is there when he is not looking, not using probes that interact with whatever it is. But between the situation in quantum physics and the situation in the study of animal behavior, there is this difference. Animal behavior goes on, observably so, even when the animals are not being experimented on. May it not be important to try to observe this behavior before we set out to change it, as we can so frighteningly do? Those who study the behavior of animals in their natural habitats nowadays have a special name for their study, ethology. Long hours of patient observation, much of it during the last 50 years, have demonstrated how intricate, how unexpectedly adaptive, how downright peculiar are the patterns of behavior specific to particular species of animals. Many of the patterns function as communication. The elaborate courtship rituals of birds, the less elaborate ones of butterflies and certain fish, the way in which two dabbling ducks on meeting lower their bills into the water and pretend to drink as an indication of non-aggressiveness, and so on. Among these behaviors, there is one that has been called truly symbolic. That is the dance of the honeybee, the symbolism of which was first recognized and deciphered by Carl von Frisch in the 1940s. Let me describe it briefly. Forager bee performs in the dark hive gives, by special symbolism, the distance and direction of the food source she has found. If, for the Austrian variety of bee, the food source is less than 80 meters away, she performs a round dance, running rapidly around in a circle, first to the left, then to the right. This, in effect, says to the hive bees, fly out from the hive. Close by in the neighborhood is food to be fetched. If, on the other hand, the food source is more than 80 meters away, the forager will use the tail wagging dance. The rhythm of the dance tells the distance. The closer the source, the more figure of eight cycles of the dance per minute. The tail wagging part of the dance, shown by the middle wavy line in the diagram, tells the direction in accordance with a curious rule. On the vertical honeycomb in the hive, the direction up means towards the sun, and the direction down means away from the sun. If the tail wagging run points 60 degrees left of straight up, the food source is 60 degrees to the left of the sun, and so on. Directions with respect to the sun have been transposed into directions with respect to gravity. The directions are reported with errors of less than 3 degrees. This same dance is used in springtime when half the bees move out of the hive and form a swarm, seeking a new nesting place. Scout bees fly out in all directions, then return and dance to announce the location they have hit on. It is important, of course, that the selected spot be protected from winter, wind, and rough weather, and that there be abundant feeding nearby. The surprising thing is that not just one nesting place is announced, but several at the same time. The dancing and the coming and going can continue for days. By their dances, the bees engage in mutual persuasion, inciting one another to inspect this site or that site. The better the site, the longer and more vigorously the returning bee dances. The process continues until all the scout bees are dancing in the same direction and at the same rate. Then the swarm arises and departs for the home site it is thus decided upon. Mistaken decisions are few. The dance of the honeybee is symbolic in a genetically determined way. That human language is not genetically determined in the same way is easy to show. The language a child learns, whether Swahili, Cantonese, Urdu, or any other, depends solely on the language of those by whom he is brought up. The vocabulary of a human language is not genetically fixed. However, I do not believe that the discussion of the biological foundations of language can properly end at this point. My reasons for saying this are two. In the first place, there are certain features of human speech which are not found in the natural communication systems of animals, but which are found universally in all human languages, present or past. The existence of these features is, at the very least, consonant with the possibility that there is a genetic foundation underlying human speech. The facts appear to be most easily accounted for by assuming that there is such a foundation, forcing human speech to be of a certain basic type. Secondly, this same assumption receives support from the study of primary language acquisition in children. It is not that Semiticos was right, or that children, if left to themselves, would commence to speak Proto-Indo-European or any language resembling an adult human language. All genetically determined traits depend for their appearance, to a greater or lesser degree, on features of the environment. The genes or genetic factors do not of themselves determine body parts or physiological or behavioral traits. Rather, they determine developmental processes which normally succeed one another in a determinate way, but can be profoundly affected by environmental influence. These facts point to the possibility that genetically determined traits might appear only in the course of maturation, and then only in response to specific influences from outside the organism. Ethologists inform us of many instances of species-specific, genetically-based behavior that emerge only in this way. An example is imprinting. Thomas More described it in his Utopia. Chicks or ducklings or goslings, a few hours or days after hatching, enter a critical period. Whatever object they first encounter during this period, within certain limits of size, and moving within appropriate limits of speed, they begin to follow and continue to follow through childhood. The object followed can be, and usually is, the mother, but it can also be an ethologist like Conrad Lorenz on his hands and knees, or something stuffed at the end of a stick. Failure to develop imprinted responses during infancy may cause behavioral abnormalities in the adult bird, abnormalities that cannot be corrected by later training. Imprinting is only one of many known species-specific characteristics or behaviors that appear in the course of development in response to what are sometimes called releasers, environmental stimuli of specified kinds. It will be my contention that important features of human linguistic capacity are of this kind. After discussing these two points, I shall conclude with certain reflections on what they might mean. begin then with three features of human speech that do not appear to be found in the natural communication systems of animals. What is meant by phonematization? The vocalization heard in the human languages of the world are always within fairly narrow limits of the total range of sounds that humans can produce. We are able to imitate, for instance, the vocalizations of mammals and birds with considerable accuracy, given a little training. But such direct imitations never seem to be incorporated in the vocabularies of human languages. In all human languages, the meaningful units, words, or more strictly speaking, morphemes, are divisible into successive, shorter, meaningless sounds called phonemes. Morphemes are the smallest meaningful units into which an utterance can be divided. A morpheme can be a single word, such as water. It can be more than one word, as in spick and span. And it can be less than a single word, as in the ER in whiter, which turns the adjective white into a comparative. Phonemes are the meaningless sounds into which morphemes can be divided. A phoneme is not, strictly speaking, a single sound, but rather a small class of sounds. It can be defined as the smallest distinctive unit functioning within the sound system of a language to make a difference. Refinements aside, the central fact I wish to convey is this. In all languages, morphemes are constituted by sequences of phonemes. This is a fact that the inventors of the alphabet may have been about the first to come to understand. The fact could have been different. One can imagine a language in which the symbol for a cat was a sound resembling a meow, in which size was represented by loudness, color by vowel quality, and hunger by a strident roar. Morphemes in such a language would not be analyzable into phonemes. All human languages are phonematized, but each language uses a somewhat different set of phonemes, in each case a small set. Parrots and minor birds excel other birds in the imitation of human speech, but it is doubtful that they speak in phonemes. The matter could be put to a test. A parrot that had heard only Portuguese and had acquired a good repertory of Portuguese words and phrases could be transferred into an environment where he would hear only English and have the opportunity of repeating English exclamatory remarks. If these remarks emerged with a Portuguese accent, then it would be clear. That the parrot had learned Portuguese phonemes, which he proceeded to use in the vocalization of English words. In the opposite case, we could conclude that the parrot had the capacity to imitate sounds accurately, but had not acquired the habit of using phonemes for the production of speech. In the human child, speech by the same test would turn out to be phonematized. The second general characteristic of human speech I have listed is concatenation. Human utterances seldom consist of single morphemes in isolation. In no human speech community are utterances restricted to single morphemes. In all languages, morphemes are ordinarily strung together into sequences. To be sure, the peoples of many, perhaps most cultures, are less garrulous than we. They use language only in certain circumstances and only somewhat sparingly, while we talk a good deal of the time. It is nevertheless true that humans in all speech communities concatenate morphemes. The third property presupposes concatenation. It is the property of grammatical or syntactical structure. By structure, I'm going to mean a set of relations that can be diagrammed. In no language are morphemes strung together in purely random order. Native speakers of a language normally agree in rejecting certain utterances as ungrammatical and in recognizing certain other utterances as grammatical. According to Noam Chomsky, for instance, the sentence, colorless green ideas sleep furiously, is grammatical, though meaningless or nearly so. the concatenation furiously sleep ideas green colorless, the same words in reverse order, is ungrammatical. The one concatenation admits of a syntactical diagram, the other does not. It is generally assumed in linguistics that the grammar of a language is completely describable by means of a finite and, in fact, small set of formal rules. For no natural language has such a description been achieved as yet, otherwise one could program a computer to utter the grammatical sentences in the language. Apparently, the mechanism involved in the grammar of a natural language is complex. I shall return to this topic again. The point now is just the universality of grammar, a relatively complex kind of system, as a feature of human languages. All three properties I have described are, so far as the available evidence indicates, without cultural histories. Phonematization, concatenation, grammatical structure are features of all known human languages, past or present. And although languages are always in process of change, it is not the case that these changes follow a general pattern from a stage that can be called primitive to one that can be called advanced. No known classification or analysis of human languages provides any basis for a theory of the development of language from aphonemic, non-grammatical, or simple unitary beginnings. These facts are consonant with the hypothesis that there is a genetic foundation underlying human speech, forcing it to be of a certain basic type, and in particular to have the features I have just described. In support of this hypothesis, I take up now the development of language in the child. The first sound a child makes is to cry. Immanuel Kant says the birth cry, I quote, has not the tone of lamentation, but of indignation and of aroused wrath, presumably because the child wants to move and feels his inability to do so as a fetter that deprives him of his freedom, end quote. More recently, a psychoanalyst has written of the birth cry, it is an expression of the infant's overwhelming sense of inferiority on thus suddenly being confronted with by reality without ever having had to deal with its problems. In view of the anatomical immaturity of the human brain at birth, these adult interpretations are rather surprising. No doubt the infant, in being born, undergoes a rude shock. But crying is a mechanism with a number of important functions. One of the earliest is clearing fluid out of the middle ear so that the child can begin to hear. The mechanism is ready to operate at birth, and the infant puts it to work. The sound made in crying changes slightly during childhood, but otherwise does not mature or change during life. Crying is not a first step in the development that leads to articulate speech. It involves no articulation. The infant simply blows his horn without operating the keys. A quite distinct sort of vocalization begins at about the sixth or eighth week after birth. Little cooing sounds that appear to be elicited by a specific stimulus, a nodding object resembling a face in the baby's visual field. A clown's face painted on cardboard, laughing or crying, will do the trick. The response is first smiling, then cooing. After about 13 weeks, it is necessary that the face be a familiar one to elicit the smiling and cooing. During cooing, some articulatory organs are moving, in particular the tongue. The cooing sounds, although tending to be vowel-like, are not identical with any actual speech sounds. Gradually, they become differentiated. At 6 months, they include vocalic and consonantal components like p and b. Cooing develops into babbling resembling one-syllable utterances, for instance, ma, mu, da, di. However, the babbling sounds are still not those of adult speech. The first strictly linguistic feature to emerge in a child's vocalization is contour of intonation. Before the sound sequences have determinable meaning or definite phonemic structure, they come out with a recognizable intonation of questions, exclamations, or affirmations. Linguistic development begins not with the putting together of individual components, but rather with a whole tonal pattern. Later, this whole becomes differentiated into component parts. Differentiation of phonemes is only approximate at first and has to be progressively refined. The child is gradually gaining control of the dozen or so adjustments in the vocal organs that are required for adult speech. By 12 months, he is replicating syllables, as in ma, ma, and da, da. By 18 months, he will normally have a repertory of 3 to 50 recognizable words. I've described this development as though mothers were not trying to teach, but of course they normally are. It is nevertheless a striking fact that these stages emerge in different cultures in the same sequence and at very nearly the same ages and in fairly strict correlation with other motor achievements. Detailed studies have been made of speech acquisition among the Zuni of New Mexico, the Dani in Dutch New Guinea, the Bororo in central Brazil, and children in urban USA. In all cases, intonation patterns become distinct at about the time that grasping between thumb and fingers develops, the first words appear at about the time that walking is accomplished, and by the time the child is able to jump, tiptoe, walk backward, he's talking a blue streak. Among children born deaf, the development from cooing through spontaneous babbling to well-articulated speech sounds occurs as with normal children. But of course, the development cannot continue onward into the stage at which adult words are learned through hearing. Among the mentally retarded, these developments are chronologically delayed, but take place with the same correlation between various motor achievements. Given the variety of environmental conditions in these several cases, it seems plausible to attribute the emergence of linguistic habits largely to maturational changes within the growing child rather than to particular training procedures. The specific neurophysiological correlates of speech are little known, but that there are such correlates and that they mature as speech develops is supported by much evidence. The human brain at birth has only 24% of its adult weight. By contrast, the chimpanzee starts life with a brain that already weighs 60% of its adult value. The human brain takes longer to mature and more happens as it matures, including principally a large increase in the number of neuronal connections. A large part of the discernible anatomical maturation takes place in the first 2 years. The process appears to be complete by about 14 years of age. By this time, the neurophysical basis of linguistic capacity has become localized in one of the two cerebral hemispheres, usually the left. If by this time a first language has not been learned, no language will ever be learned. Speech defects due to injuries to the brain that occur before the final lateralization of the speech function are usually overcome. But if the injury comes after lateralization, the speech defect will be permanent. Capacity for speech does not correlate uniformly with size of brain.